You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, March 7th, 2016. My name is Michael Brooks, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Stephen A. Cook, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're going to be talking about a shaky ceasefire in Syria, a press crackdown in Turkey, and who are the quote-unquote Kurds. There's at least three different factions fighting on that side of the equation, and we're going to get specific, get a little bit wonky. Also, my old teammate Matt Binder joins us. And Matt is tremendously excited because after a career of goading right-wing people on social media, he actually went in person to CPAC and goaded them in real life. He also took a picture with Dana Perino, which is really one of the most surreal things I've ever seen in my life. I can picture a lot of things. I couldn't picture that one until it happened. Crazy stuff. Also, going to go over some results from Iran's elections last week. Who won? How President Buhari in Nigeria is fighting corruption. And we have a lot of sound from last night's explosive Democratic debate where both of these candidates really showed, and I'm sorry, I apologize, I don't mean to be ageist or whatever, but they're exhausted. And it was really clear watching it. And it's a totally brutal schedule unless you're doing Donald Trump thing where you're just like dropping in and talking nonsense for an hour. Exactly. Word. They are as exhausted as we were covering it. So things got a little bit snippy, but there was actually some real substance to it. Dinesh D'Souza has a new movie coming out, and I think he's actually more insane than anybody else in that world, in the world. I know guys sniffing paint thinner talking to me about Jesus in front of Penn Station who make more sense than Dinesh D'Souza. It's unbelievable. Did you say me too? I get it. There's a thought structure to it. I understand. Jesus is the way. Paint thinner makes you feel good. There's a coherence to it that is lacking from Dinesh D'Souza. Dude is out of his mind. We're running a little bit tight, but really quickly, I always want to do the check-in with my teammates here. What's going on? How was the weekend, everybody?
My weekend was good. I watched Girls, which I'd kind of like gotten over a bit.
Could you say that again, please?
I watched Girls on HBO.
No, five. You didn't say it like that the first time.
I watched Girls on HBO.
Okay.
And I don't know, it's fine.
All right. That sounds fun, Matt. And you, Miss Kelly, what's the word?
My weekend was terrific.
Was it fantastic?
It was fantastic.
Was it tremendous?
It was tremendous.
Did you do a great job?
I did a great job.
Awesome.
My weekend, the weather was really nice here in New York.
Yes.
But it bothered my allergies and stuff, so I would imagine that a lot of people were in the same boat, the weather changing.
I'm so thankful I don't get allergies anymore. But yes, yeah. This is the season for it. Really quick, I just want to read an email that we got from a listener, and this is a little bit truncated. It doesn't include his name, obviously, but I thought it was interesting. He said, Dear MR, the Dems were in Flint, yet they couldn't even make a connection to Flint and Governor Schneider's Republican small government approach. What a waste of an opportunity to imply, to simply say that Democrats don't kill people to make slash save money. Unquote. If Flint had occurred under a Dem governor, Ted Cruz would milk it for all it was worth, calling it the worst crisis in American history by terrorist, radical, leftist Democrats. Demo rats, I understand. I worked banquets back in 2011 and served Perry, Jindal, and Rubio in Florida. I don't have any recordings, but I listened. They believe in privatization of everything. Jindal spoke of the advantages if we had a privatized police forces. That's their solution. The Kochs and the Republicans' ideology are synonymous. Dems failed at making that case. I think you're right. They could have made actually an even sharper case and really gotten to the full implications of what is going on in Flint. And I just wanted to kind of highlight that note to hit again. These people are radical extremists. And there's no difference between them and Donald Trump. And we'll get into the pop culture attack on Donald Trump, the SNL attack later. But as a foreshadowing, let me just say this should have happened a lot earlier. But let's get to some advertising, and then we'll be right back with Stephen Cook. If you are hiring, what kind of candidate do you want? Obviously you want the best candidate. And as a consigliere to a business owner, I can tell you that your company is only as good as the people you hire. I can also tell you that posting a job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. But when you're short-staffed and there's no real time to deal with a dozen different websites, until now, thanks to ZipRecruiter.com, you can post up to 100-plus job sites with a single click and be instantly matched with candidates from over 6 million resumes. Just post once, and within 24 hours, watch your candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. It's an incredibly easy-to-use interface. ZipRecruiter has been used by over 400,000 businesses, and you can try it now for free. Getting the right people for your company is so important. Try ZipRecruiter and get the perfect candidate before they go to somebody else. Today, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. And again, third time because it's so pivotal. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Get started for free today. And in order to also live a successful modern life, you need something which a lot of us don't pay enough attention to. And that is a good night's sleep. It's true. It's really true. You can't run around exhausted and fatigued all the time. And today's sponsor, Casper Mattress, is obsessively engineered American-made mattresses at a shockingly low price. And now you can get up to $50 towards any mattress by going to Casper.com by Casper/majority and using the code majority. That's Casper.com/majority. Listen, you spend about a third of your life sleeping. Let's make sure you're doing it on a good mattress. Casper brings together two comfy technologies for better nights and better days: latex foam and memory foam. I love that memory foam. They've got just the right sink, just the right bounce, no matter how you sleep. They've got a risk-free trial and return policy. They'll deliver it straight to you, and you can try it for 100 days. Think about it. You go to a mattress store, you bounce on it for 5 minutes, and you make this major decision. That's why you have 100 days. And if you're not happy, they'll pick it right back up. But, of course, you're going to be happy. At the store, maybe you'll get a minute on a mattress with Casper. You get to actually sleep on it. It's $500 for a twin-size mattress, $950 for a king-size mattress. Comparing that to industry averages, that's an astounding price point. So get $50 toward any mattress purchase by going to Casper.com/majority and using the code word majority. That's Casper.com/majority. Code word majority. Terms and conditions apply. We will be right back with Stephen Cook on the Majority Report. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I am Michael Brooks, and joining us now is Stephen Cook. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and my amigo. Steve, how you doing?
All right. How are you, man?
I'm doing great.
Good.
So let's start. We want to kind of, you know, track the region with you, do a holistic analysis as we usually do together, and actually maybe towards the end of the conversation migrate back to something that we wrote together about a year ago. And see how it's holding up. But let's start, before we move into the bigger picture, with an update from Turkey. You and I have kind of talked about really the devolution of President Erdogan from, you know, a leader that I would never sort of pick as my ideal politician by any stretch of the imagination. But the beginning of his government in 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005, you had a very interesting example of the potential of really just a sort of Euro-style center-right Islamic cultural party. And now we've devolved to a point where, and this has been a long-running process, but the closing down of today's Zaman, which is a very important newspaper in Turkey, it has interesting ownership, and there's some questions around it in and of itself, but it was nonetheless an important outlet, and it has just been shut down. I mean, this sort of nakedness is, I mean, there's very little subtlety. It's incredibly brazen. So talk about that specific action and place it in the context of the devolution of President Erdogan's leadership in the present situation in Turkey.
It's a great question, Michael. Thanks for it. You know, the events in Turkey related to Zaman, which is the Turkish version of the paper, and today's Zaman, which is the English version, is, you know, if you could be shocked but not surprised, that is exactly my response last week when a trustee was appointed to take over the paper and basically shut it down. And this is the culmination of 7 or 8 years of an illiberal and then quite clearly authoritarian turn in Turkish politics. Right. You're quite right. In between 2002 and 2005, many people had looked upon the Justice and Development Party as kind of the, you know, the Turkish analog of the Christian Democrats in Europe, and that's precisely what the AKP, the Erdogan and Abdullah Gül and other founders of the party wanted people to believe.
Right.
Yet over the course of, as I said, 7 or 8 years, there has been this turn, and it's a complicated story, but essentially, President Erdogan, who was prime minister in between 2003 and August 2014, is clearly not a Democrat, as you intimated when you said he's not the leader for you, but has sought to actually crush the opposition. This is someone who is paranoid, which is good in a politician, but also a right. Turkish Islamist has, you know, extra paranoid because they see a coup coming around every corner. Wants to dominate the region, believes that he and he only can transform the country. He's become this expression of the Justice and Development Party, which is really a shell of what it once was. And he has a rather large constituency, better than 40% of the electorate, that believes in him, believes he's the great master. He has brought them health care, a sense of greater wealth, transportation. The country is transformed, not just in an authoritarian way, but also in a lot of other ways that benefit people, and that's why he keeps winning elections despite being an authoritarian.
Right. I mean, it's kind of the quintessential sort of Turkey, if you think of it in that second world terminology that some people use. And there's no doubt that under his leadership, and I mean, I remember seeing it even when I was there in, 2007, 2008, you could watch in real time the relaxation of credit, the building boom, and then you saw this fusion. I mean, I lived in a neighborhood in Ankara which actually was dominated by people that came from like the southern part of Turkey, like Şanlıurfa. So it was a very religious neighborhood, very kind of culturally conservative, and at the same time, it was booming with consumer spending. And I think that, that sort of fusion of kind of middle class aspirational religiosity can be very familiar to people, but there already was the sense. Yeah, sorry, go
ahead. It's the absolute sweet spot. You know, people, lower middle class people feeling wealthier, a kind of relaxation of the official secularism so that people could explore their Muslim identities in new ways, safer, in public places. So this was the great genius behind the electoral success of the Justice and Bell Party. It was not just the economics, but it was also an issue of identity. And what you're articulating is exactly right.
Right. I mean, that identity is a problem that is very hard to solve in a globalizing world, and it's very hard to match the sort of need for material advancement and the need to have a grounded identity. And what they did was they spoke to the demographics in a way that in Turkey had been, you know, completely outside of the base of elite conversation. But the other thing, and we'll get this, we'll connect this to the Kurds in a moment, but the other thing that's interesting is that, you know, and obviously this has a lot of implications, and, you know, it's funny because you're at the council and there's a conversation like this, which is very policy driven and kind of empirical. And then there's this sort of like, you know, hashtag cult online and the sort of Frank Gaffneys of the world that, you know, run through Islamist conspiracy theories all day and you know, the evil Muslims are at every corner and blah, blah, blah. But it is interesting, and it is not in any ways as an excuse in any way for what's happening with AKP in Erdogan in any way, shape, or form. But what's interesting is that in some respects, his reversion to authoritarianism is less connected. I mean, it's connected socially with some Islamic politics, but the notion of centralizing power, the notion of demonizing Kurds, the notion of, you know, outside forces that want to delegitimize Turkey. I mean, this is like a profound reversion to type in the sense of like classical Turkish authoritarian leadership.
That's right. And remember that, you know, the AKP has a number of different constituencies. Included in that constituency, and there's a significant amount of overlap, are hardcore nationalists. And the overlap is with the Nationalist Movement Party. And what Erdogan has been doing, and I think he could, and today's developments with the EU, which we can get into, I think, is clearly going to help Erdogan if there are early elections, and he may wipe out the Nationalist Movement Party. They may not meet the threshold to enter parliament because he has tacked so hard to the right on the Nationalist Party. The thing about Erdogan is that there is this kind of ostentatiousness about the AKP and personal piety and so on and so forth, but he strikes me as someone who's actually less pious than someone, for example, like Abdullah Gül or other leading members of the AKP. And it really has become about Erdogan's vision of himself as the greatest Turkish leader and his transformation of society. That's not to say that he's not pious, and that he's not, but it's of a different sort. And the way to do this is to do it in a specifically non-democratic authoritarian way, because he knows it. He knows what's right. This is, you know, you have spent a lot of time there. This is a patrimonial society. I'm not making a cultural argument. I think it's clear. And he plays on that. He plays on this idea of him as a father and this important source of authority and so on and so on. And people have tended to respond to it. But you're absolutely right. He has reverted to kind of classical centralization of power, demonization of Kurds, demonization of all opponents. The West is out to get you. You know, look, we talked a bit about, you spoke a bit about, you know, the easy credit and people feeling wealthier and stuff. Since the Gezi Park protests in 2013, Erdogan has been preparing his constituency for the economic crash and the fact that he has been hammering away at the interest rate lobby, international bankers, Zionists, Islamophobes, is an effort to insulate himself from criticism on the economic front. And this is all part of this big play to kind of transform the country and to accumulate power at the expense of everybody else.
Absolutely. And just, I guess, as an olive branch to, I know, the many sort of anti-religious folks who listen and watch this program, I mean, in some respects, some of Erdogan's egotism is a product particular of, like, in some respects, you can only have that level of egotism with that level of piety. But being that as it may, you know, let's get to the EU and then we'll move to Turkey. It's been a fascinating process to watch because, you know, obviously, you know, several years ago, this notion of Turkey actually joining the EU was something that was really on the table. Clearly, it's, you know, the likelihood of that, if it was ever really high to begin with, is a lot lower now. And we're seeing, you know, Turkey, Europe, you know, kind of just trying to balance, like on one hand, okay, Turkey's a partner, but Turkey also has a conflictual attitude towards, you know, policy with regards to the Kurds and with regards to migrants. So tell us about what's the conversation that's happening now in Europe and where the state of play is with that.
Right. Well, you know, as you know, there was this emergency EU summit today in order to deal with the migrant crisis.
Right.
And previously, the Europeans have offered the Turks 3 billion euros to help manage the European migrant crisis, their Syrian refugees. And a number of other issues were on the table, including, you know, loosening restrictions on visas for Turks in the Schengen zone, right, and so on and so forth. And the Europeans were heavily criticized for this. But it seemed, you know, from a kind of coldly rational, realist perspective, really the only way they were going to get Turkey to play ball.
Right.
The concern was that the Turks would pocket the money and not do anything. Lo and behold, the Turks say they haven't gotten the money that they were promised, and the migrant crisis continues. Well, today, the European Union got together with the Turks, and there's a new agreement on the table, and that's to double, that's to add an additional 3 billion euros to the Turks to help manage the crisis, that Turkey would readmit migrants coming into the Greek islands, and that for every Syrian refugee readmitted into Turkey, the EU would settle a Syrian refugee in the EU. And there's also this Schengen agreement thing, loosening the restrictions on Turks who want to travel in the Schengen zone. And an interesting new twist is speeding up Turkey's EU membership, which is something, as you point out, people had tremendous high hopes for in 2004 and 2005. It has basically been moribund since.
Right.
This is, again, this is something, this is practically the only thing that the Europeans can do to get the Turks to play ball and help them stem the tide of people trying to get into Europe, for which they're manifestly unprepared. But they should be clear, the Europeans should understand that the Turks are gearing up for yet another round of early elections so that Erdogan and the AKP can get an even bigger parliamentary majority in order to change the constitution, in order to establish what Erdogan calls an executive presidency, in which would make the prime minister irrelevant and all the power would flow back to Erdogan, as if the power doesn't flow to Erdogan, but in a formal sense,
right,
he would again be the key player in Turkish politics. And I think that's the upshot. I think, you know, and the EU is signaling that it's okay with this as long as the Turks play ball on helping out with the refugee crisis.
Right. So this is, so what's fascinating about this, and this is what can lead us to the Kurds, is I also remember the counterpoint again, and maybe just to fill in some details, when Erdogan first came into power, you know, Turkey took steps on human rights law and on free speech law that no governments had undertaken previously in order to align with the EU.
Right.
They made moves on the environment. They made moves on many, and they negotiated with the Kurds. There were a lot of areas that, again, this, you know, right-leaning religious conservative government, which would not be like, you know, the sort of party that someone like you or I would probably necessarily support, but they were in a position where they were making the progressive moves. And, you know, I think, you know, there's that terminology in democracy studies of sort of internalizing versus discoursing democracy. And I think we, you know, mm-hmm. it's clear what it is with Erdogan. But that said, the foreign policy counterpoint of the domestic policy was this notion of no problems foreign policy and synchronized foreign
right.
policy. So basically, the notion was that, you know, instead of trying to just emulate the ultra-secular West, Turkey can be everything simultaneously. It can be Western and Islamic. It can be democratic and Muslim. It can be, you know, East and West. It can bridge Europe and Asia. It can actually, you know, facilitate to Africa. It will still have a special relationship with the United States. And then as a result of that, that's where negotiate with the Kurds comes in. That's where have an amicable and easy relationship with Iran and Syria, still move towards the EU. And again, this sounds ludicrous now as we articulate it, but this is actually something that was relatively happening when this party was first in power. Now it's like all problems all the time.
Right.
What's going on?
Well, I think your characterization of it is spot on. The Turks did seem to be able to manage all of the different facets of its foreign policy, so that in 2007, after the AKP was reelected, you could say that Turkey was more democratic, more European, more Muslim, and nationalist all at the same time, and they somehow had this secret sauce that they can make it all work together. And as then when the Arab uprisings began, Erdogan was the first world leader to say that Hosni Mubarak should listen to his people and leave. And that kind of led people to believe that, oh, the Turks, this Muslim party, it has some sort of special insight into the Middle East, when it really didn't. I mean, if you look deeper, this no problems with your neighbors problem was really, there was a lot of anti-Zionism, anti-Israel stuff. There was a lot of Muslim solidarity stuff. And then it was basically a kind of economic determinism. So they were perfectly willing to deal with Muammar Gaddafi. Erdogan was a recipient of the Muammar Gaddafi Award in International Human Rights.
I wish he was alive today, because I'm aiming for that. So it's a little bit of a sore point for me, Steve, that you got to bring that up, man.
And they were very close to the Assads, and actually, there was a logic to the relationship with the Assads, which was to try to peel Bashar away from the Iranians and Hezbollah.
Right.
And the problem is that Erdogan and Davutoglu believed that they were doing it. When someone had whispered in Bashar's ear, whether it was his father on his deathbed or one of his father's henchmen, who said, look, when you get into trouble, the only place you can go and the only people you can trust is Tehran. Right. And that's really where the beginning of the end began for the Turks in the Middle East. The Syrian uprising, their inability to influence Bashar al-Assad, which they had told everybody that they could do, and that Turkey really was, even though they never used the term, that Turkey was a model, it didn't obviously work out the way they had expected. And then, we're off and running other events. The coup d'etat in Egypt. There was a principled position that Ankara took on this, but it wrecked its relations not just with Egypt, but with the Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, the Bahrainis, the Kuwaitis, and the Israelis, for obvious reasons they had very difficult relations with. So if you look at Turkey now things have improved somewhat with Syria as a result of the emergency that Syria is. But if you look at Turkey in 2011 and you look at Turkey in 2016, its strategic position in the region has just cratered. And it's no longer the model. Young Arabs aren't looking towards Istanbul and Ankara as, a model for them, because it's no longer a democratic country. It looks like, a democratizing country from their perspective. It looks more like an old Middle Eastern autocracy than it does some country that is, becoming more democratic and prosperous.
With worse suits.
With
worse suits, because at least the Saudis and the Emiratis got that kind of cool look going on. Erdogan looks like a harried, kind of like nasty banker. Yeah.
Right. That's exactly right.
Right.
So the Turks are in it has been a domestic and foreign policy failure. However, Erdogan is sort of the Teflon Don of Turkey. Nothing sticks to him, because if he loses, he wins. If he wins, he wins at the same time, no matter what the issue is.
Right. So he's a bit like Trump in that regard. And actually, very specifically, I don't mean that flippantly, because he's been able to merge his identity with a certain cultural identity in Turkey so seamlessly that it's like, when we're winning because I'm expressing you perfectly. And when we're losing, it's because we have all the right enemies, which I'm the only person that can resist.
That's right.
So
that's right.
Yeah.
And those enemies are, the U.S. ambassador, Washington, Zionists, Islamophobes, and the Europeans, foreigners. I mean, we discussed it before. Erdogan is, and I write a bit about this in my new book, Erdogan is kind of that expression of what the AKP thinks of as the new Turkish man, unapologetic, powerful, pious, speaks to Turkey's past, present, and future greatness. These are things that are deeply resonant with the core constituency of the AKP. And that's why one of the reasons why they've been so successful.
Absolutely. So let's get briefly into the Kurds and the ceasefire in Syria. Now, you know, I don't think it's no mystery to anybody that follows my work that I have a lot of sympathy for the Kurds. But I think it is important to disaggregate, which you have in a recent piece at the Council on your blog at the Council on Foreign Relations, to sort of say, when we're talking about the Kurds, we're actually, it's very important to note, like, we have Kurds in Syria that represent a radical leftist faction, and they're fighting ISIS. I have immense sympathy for them. Then we have Kurds in Turkey that I do have sympathy for, but the PKK undoubtedly engages in some acts of terrorism inside Turkey. That's indisputable. And then in Iraq, you have, like, kind of the real, more like the kind of realo Kurds. I mean, these guys are real operators in a certain way. They're all opposed to ISIS, and they're all creating contradictions in U.S. and European policy, and I would argue exposing other disturbing aspects of Turkish policy. I mean, there's nothing wrong with Turkey saying, obviously, we can't accept terrorism coming from anybody, but I think there still is, it's quite revealing that you could, you know, equate the PKK with ISIS. You know, disaggregate the different Kurdish groups, and then maybe that could lead into how this ceasefire is or isn't going.
Well, disaggregating the Kurds, it's, look, I think the important thing to understand is that they all, the Turkish Kurds, the Syrian Kurds, the Iraqi Kurds, the Iranian Kurds, they are disconnected in a variety of ways, but they are connected in important, integral ways. And their politics, the politics of the Kurds, which is kind of a meaningless thing because these groups are quite different, but the politics of the Kurds affect all of them simultaneously. And so from the if you're looking at it from the perspective of Turkey, you have, you know, 14 million Kurds that live within Turkey. It's about 20% of the population. Many of them are well integrated into the politics and society and economy of the country. And you have these separatist terrorists that have been waging a war against the Turkish state since 1984. That's the Turkish perspective. Now there's, you know, degrees of subtlety here. And add now that in the disintegration of Syria, the PKK has helped establish the YPG, which are the People's Protection Units, which is part of this Syrian Kurdish political movement.
Right.
And because of the disintegration of Syria, there seems to be a possibility that the Syrian Kurds will be able to establish some sort of independent entity along Syria's border with Turkey. And from the Turkish perspective, this means that, you know, the PKK and the YPG, PKK is a terrorist organization, YPG is a terrorist group by association, even though the YPG coordinates with the United States in the fight against ISIS, and the United States says the YPG is very effective in that fight. From the Turkish perspective, there is this possibility of a terrorist state on its border that will have an effect on Turkish Kurds, leading to the disintegration of the Turkish state. This is the nightmare. This goes back to 1920, the Treaty of Sèvres, when the Allied forces in post-World War I, with the exception of the United States, actually sought to carve up Anatolia. This is what Turkish children have been learning in school from the moment the Turkish Republic was established, the Treaty of Sèvres, and the double dealing of foreign hands trying to dismember the Turkish Republic. Now it looks like it's coming to be, and the United States, the big strategic ally of Turkey, is helping Kurds. And it's very hard for them to distinguish between Syrian Kurds, Turkish Kurds, who's a terrorist, who's not a terrorist. And this is the major issue that's going on. And that's why, despite a ceasefire in Syria, the Turks are shelling YPG positions in Syria. They have not stopped.
Which is, yeah.
So, you know, the war continues. The war will continue. But it's now, it's hard to say that it's a war just about Syria. It's multifaceted in a variety of different ways that no one could have anticipated. And the United States is really at a decision point. You're quite right. The PKK and the YPG, they're not ISIS. And Washington needs to determine what its where its interests lie in this fragmenting area. Iraq and Syria are clearly fragmenting, despite, you know, some decent news from Iraq recently, but not really, obviously, quite good. All the trends are in the bad direction. And Washington is caught while saying, you know, magically YPG fighters are effective fighters against ISIS when they're on the Syrian side of the border, but when they cross into Turkey, they're terrorists. And that's the distinction that the United States has tried to make, and no one buys it. The Kurds don't buy it. People like me don't buy it. You don't buy it. The Turks don't buy it. Nobody buys it. The only people who keep telling themselves this is the United States. Even CENTCOM doesn't believe this.
Right.
So right. It's...
Well, because they have an actual strategic, like they can't lose themselves in the sort of like, you know, political nonsense. But I like that would be a funny Obama bit of like this side not a terrorist, that side terrorist. You know, there could be something funny that. Look, you went to the wrong side. So two more questions. One, I mean, it actually seems like this ceasefire, which, you know, includes all of the players other than Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS, obviously. And in some respects, it's very frustrating to me because it leads us to a place that if you've taken a very, very realist perspective on the situation, because, again, it should be just noted that just on a purely humanitarian level, I mean, Assad still has a bigger body count than ISIS. I mean, you're really right. Talking an absolutely obscene regime. But want a regime that has very genuine constituencies and very genuine networks behind it. And it's not just like, you know, a head that can be cut off of a snake. It's a hydra. It's not like Gaddafi. It is embedded. But it seems like, you know, we've gotten to this point of looking at it from a realist perspective. And it's kind of holding up, which is sort of astonishing. I mean, how does that seem to be playing out to you?
Well, I think that there is, and there's been from almost the start, kind of influential view that, you know, Assad, after everybody got over the Assad will fall in a matter of weeks kind of insanity of late 2011, and the kind of extremist phenomenon really kicked into high gear, I think there's been a fair number of people in Washington and elsewhere who've signaled, well, you know, Assad is better than extremists. Right. And in a way, and I hate to say this, you know, I once wrote a piece called Assad-O-Masochism, where I said, look, you can fight ISIS and Assad all at the same time. We don't have to get into bed with Assad. But they do, this realist perspective, there is a point that they make, and I think it's a good one, and it's worth considering. ISIS is a group, and other extremists are a group. They have a kind of cosmic. They're engaged in a cosmic battle,
right?
To recreate the caliph, there is no giving any quarter to anybody. Whereas Assad, anybody who knew anything knew he was going to kill many, many, many thousands upon thousands of people to get himself out of the problem that he's in.
Right.
But I think there's a sense you can actually deal with the Syrian regime, however it may come out in the end. Whereas ISIS, you're going to be fighting because this is a worldview.
Right.
Assad is like, it's like a crime family.
It's like the Sinaloa cartel or something. You can do business. You can,
right,
yeah,
exactly,
you can cut
exactly
a deal. Right.
Exactly.
Right.
But again, it gives me the skeevies personally, the idea that we would get into bed with Assad. I firmly believe we can fight both. But, you know, it doesn't seem, I think the administration, like with a lot of things in the Middle East, they've really tried to split the difference between two views or two issues that is very hard to, and it sometimes makes things worse.
So that's a good place for this final question. And I should say, as a preamble to this, you and I clearly need to write some more articles together because there's a lot going on.
All right, let's do it.
So a year and about 14, 15 months ago, you and I wrote a piece for Al Monitor called The Myth of Obama's Middle East Failure. And what we were doing in that piece was, first of all, noting successes. Like, I think we've been very vindicated on the Iran deal. That has definitely on balance.
And you were more bullish than I was, so credit to you.
Oh, very, very bullish on that. And thank you. But, you know, so we called that. And then the other point of this article, which I was not to say that they haven't made significant mistakes, and I think you can certainly critique those. I critique some of those from the left. Other people critique it from the right. Other people critique it just from policy procedure. But the kind of core point was that this is a region and a system that, as a result of Western meddling and intervention, as a result of, you know, stagnation in their own regimes, as a result of all sorts of failures and problems from economic to political and social, that it was not resilient. It was a fragile, system, so that even if you looked on the outside and you thought, okay, all these dictators have everything under control, they do not. Whether it's economic, whether it's religious, it is not under control. And so the point was that this is not blowing up because the Obama administration has had some grand screw up. It's blowing up because the contradictions and the instability cannot contain itself anymore. So I guess my question is, I mean, do you still think we were right on that? That essentially, of course, you can point out many mistakes, but that these trends are much deeper than any kind of policy choice of any given administration.
I think that's right. You know, what I keep saying to people, and I go to these meetings in Washington, and, you know, we're supposed to be objective, but everybody, you know, kind of reverts to where they feel most comfortable politically, except for me, of course. And I say to people, I say, hey, folks, the Middle East is hard. Right. It's very hard. You know, I just spent some time reading over what virtually everybody was saying about the Middle East and what the United States should do after the Arab uprisings. This is in 2011 and 2012 and so on and so on. And this stuff, people are just straining to say stuff. And my point, and I wrote about this, my point was that it's not that people aren't smart, they're not accomplished, they don't understand. It's that these problems pre-existed, they continue to exist, and they're very, very hard. And some of them are just beyond the United States. Now, sure, the Obama administration has made some grievous errors, I believe. I think they're not the one in Libya that everybody keeps talking about, Benghazi. That's not the mistake. There were other mistakes related to Libya, but you can play that over and over and over again. That was a really difficult decision to make. You can make arguments about the way in which they've tried to split the difference between, you know, the uprising in Syria and some sort of accommodation with Assad. But these are things that are not easy, as I said, not easy calls, and that these are problems primarily of the making of people in the region that are going to be solved by people in the region, not solved by the United States.
Absolutely. Stephen Cook, we got a lot of articles to write together, my brother.
We do. All right, let's do that.
All right, man. I'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much.
I'll see you in New York soon, I hope.
Excellent. All right, see you soon. All right, be well.
Have a good one.
Thank you. You too.
Bye.
All right, everybody, we are going to be right back with a very special guest, a very special Eminem reunion on The Majority Report. We'll be right back.
And it's a protege, eh? Chronics are where you say, eh? Sunshine, rivers, and trees.
When me see Jah, me see a way. Drastically straight from hypocrisy, I say, hey. Every man to them own a philosophy. I live the proper way and then me read a chapter daily. Man, they in a city hungry and no eat. And food they down a country, does a drop off of the tree then. You see, say poverty no real then. Is what the reason revealing.
Welcome back to The Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. I am incredibly excited to welcome my former partner in crime, and frankly, someone who still is my partner in crime. You have no idea what we're plotting and scheming together. He used to be of The Majority Report. Now he is a writer and video producer at cafe.com. And still and always, the best goader of right-wing morons and various idiots on Twitter. He's the guru of that. He's the president. He's the king. He's the monarch. He's the sovereign of the trolling of the trolls. My great friend, Matt Binder. How you doing, brother?
Wow, Michael. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Quite the the introduction. I don't know if I can. I hope I can live up to that.
I hope so too. So, Matt, what I love is that you texted me last week, and ever since I've known you, obviously, and we've known each other, I guess, for about like 3.5 years now, and we used to work together every day. And after the show would be over, we would talk shop, and I would be off, you know, doing whatever it was I needed to do, and then we would, you know, we'd IM each other, whatever. And then usually, like, around 3 p.m., I'd hear this, like, the infamous Binder cackle. And I'd be like, dude, what is it? And you'd either say, like, I just remembered that joke that you did about Bill Clinton killing somebody. Or you'd say, or you would say, I just retweeted this guy who said he hates black people, but then asked for, like, a free meal at Wendy's and then blamed Obama for not getting it. And it's really funny. And it was really funny and really disturbing. And you texted me last week and you said, dude, they're sending me to CPAC. And I was like, oh my God, Binder all of a sudden is leaving virtual reality to do what he does in real life with these people. That's insane. So what happened, dude? You were at CPAC.
I went to CPAC, yes. And I got to say, it was quite the event, man. It's you got to go, really. You can't really
sure
watch it on TV or follow it online.
Right.
I mean, the first thing, let's start right off the bat and, like, blow people's minds.
Yes.
I went and I left saying to myself, wow, those people were extremely nice.
I buy that. A lot of those people are I have to say, on a certain type of personal level, sometimes, like, conservatives are nicer than liberals, like, on a certain social nicety lane. Like, if you're not gay,
yeah,
and you're not black and you're not any number of other things that, you know. But you look a little Palestinian or something, so that's still super impressive that they were nice to you.
Yeah, I was getting stared at. I really,
right.
I mean, in the regular world, you know, William Temple, the Tea Party colonial garb wearing guy, would get stared at anywhere else.
True,
but him there, he was totally fine. No one, that's normal. Me, I was the weirdo there.
So. Absolutely.
No, but I mean, the people there are really likable, and you know what? I do,
right,
have to hand it to also, like, the Republicans who I saw there, like the politicians and the media people, like the Fox News pundits and the like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they make themselves really accessible there,
right,
which was really surprising to me. Like, I can't, like, Scott Walker and Rick Santorum were just walking around on the floor,
well,
taking selfies with people.
I mean, they're losers. Let's be real.
No, of course, no, of course.
Yeah.
But, like, it really was shocking that, like,
right,
these are the people who hate the liberal, like, they hate the media, and, like, literally they're Stacey Dash giving everyone possible interview. Grover Norquist is open to people just coming up to him, shoving a camera in his face, and he's totally down to giving an interview. It was
right,
really surprising to see that.
So in some ways, what you're saying, like, they're more like that they actually, that kind of thing where they rant about the elites and not being accessible and all this, they're kind of practicing what they preach there. They're super available. Did you get to talk to Stacey Dash?
We did not.
Did
we
you tell
so
her
close.
I said hi?
We even got her.
All
we
right.
Even,
All right.
We even got her. Yeah, we,
thanks,
were
Matt,
to, we were close enough to say hi.
Well,
but,
tell her
I
said hi specifically. Thanks, Matt.
Oh,
way to go.
Yeah, I'll have to do that next time.
Yeah, way to have
no,
my back.
We got
back.
Her information. We're going to get her next time. No, but the interesting thing about that,
yeah,
to bring up Stacey Dash, is,
mm-hmm,
there were panels where it's literally, like, super clear to me that conservatives, for all their hatred of Hollywood, is because that they want to be a part of it so bad.
Totally. Yes.
There were so many entertainment, like, industry panels there.
Right.
And the people who were sitting at these panels when it came to question and like Q&A time, so many people, audience members in the panel, their questions were like, how can I break into the industry? What can I do to get into the industry and not turn my back on my conservative ideology and stay true to it? It was basically,
that's
like,
cute,
how can I be a conservative in the entertainment industry but not sell out? Like, that was their whole...
That's
their,
awesome. So I really want to make... I want to do comedy vehicles, but I also really want to make sure that we carpet bomb ISIS. I just want to make sure...
And, you know, it's funny. Yeah. Great you bring up the comedy aspect, because,
yeah,
another thing is, you know, online and in, you know, in the media on their shows, they're always bringing up that they've got conservative comedians who are funny, and it's the media holding down their comedians.
Rump, rump, rump.
But, like, that's just... That's just their for show, though. At CPAC, everyone in these entertainment industry panels, and even the panelists themselves, like the people who are like, you know, the agents and such for these talents, they even were like, you know, we don't have a Jon Stewart. Our people aren't funny.
Like, oh, they acknowledged
it. Admitting it, like,
they owned it.
Yeah, like they're becoming self-aware. It's sort of weird.
Why do you think that is super weird? Did they have any? Because honestly, like, it's not. Like, look, if we're being real, like, we, you know, everybody can be like, kind of, you know, make their points, make, be, you know, kind of dicks about it. That's fine. But like, if you go to acting and you could say, like, all right, a guy like Robert Duvall is like an arch conservative, but he's obviously one of the best actors around. Like, it's not like, it's a fun cheap shot to say like only the talented or people are liberal or whatever. I mean, that's obviously not true. But with the exception of like occasionally like shock jock radio, which can be funny, but it's not even like, that's not conservative per se, you know what I mean? Like, there really is no one out. I mean,
exactly.
it could be reactionary, it could be homophobic, it could be all that, but there are very few people out. Like, there is no equivalent of a guy like, you know, before he was a senator, like Al Franken. Okay, like, you can get tired of him just sort of making the Democratic case, but he was a funny dude. Like, he just was a comedic talent. Right? Or Jon Stewart, it's pretty obvious where he stands. Like, these are pretty funny people. I don't think they're as funny as like Dave Chappelle, but like, whatever. There's no one on the conservative side like that. And did they have any thought of like, why can't we do this?
Well, they didn't really bring it up on the comedy side, other than the fact that, you know, they don't have anyone who's funny. But when they start talking about, this was like an entertainment industry panel. So film, and then you had book, like, publishers. And the interesting part came from the publishers, actually. And we were, you know, at Cafe, we were shooting a lot of this stuff and doing interviews that I'll get to in a second. But let's stick with this book thing. They brought up how when a conservative book fails to do well,
right,
they literally go ahead and blame everything but the fact that it's quite possible that the book just plain sucks.
Right.
They brought up how the New York Times bestseller list, that it's based on something in secret, and they were dying to know, like, it's some big conspiracy that, like,
we
it's
want
not
here.
Based on actual, like, the book scan sales.
Hold on one
and
second, here. Matt. I don't know what's going on. I'm sorry. That was a classic. That was a Sam Cedar thing where he left a bunch. Of course, he left everything open, and one started playing an advertisement. I'm sorry, dude. Go ahead.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
So the New York Times thing is an interesting thing,
right,
but they bring it up like it's a conspiracy specifically made to stop conservative books from doing well. Mm-hmm. And another interesting thing that really plays into the conservative ideology is they think their books don't do so well because there's a movement specifically to disenfranchise these books from doing well. For example, they weren't blaming, you know, the bookstore corporate bigwigs, you know, maybe they at the top are just like, we don't want to promote these books, we don't want to put them in prominent positions, we don't think they're going to do well, or maybe because they're liberals, because all liberals are the bigwigs in these entertainment industries, they just don't want to promote it even if it's despite themselves. No, they blame like the $12 an hour Barnes & Noble bookstore manager who maybe in one region will take Bill O'Reilly's latest or Ben Carson's latest, and instead of placing it in the politics section, they'll go ahead and put it in the comedy section.
That's incredible. I mean, that's actually what I find funny about that is, I mean, first of all, like, I think you've obviously never been inside a Barnes & Noble and looked at like the exhausted, hardworking people. Like no one that I've seen working at Barnes & Noble looks to me like, how can I mess up where books are placed? Like, they're doing an actual job there. The other thing is, like, and this always seems to come up, right, that the people who, like, will go, like, you know, they would tell a 10-year-old in Flint who got lead poisoning to, like, take self-responsibility. But then when it comes to, like, their infrastructure of endless crap that they can produce, not doing well because it's crazy and redundant, it's always somebody's fault.
You could also make, the analogy to, like, voter fraud. Like,
right.
Is there, I'm sure, regional Barnes & Noble bookstore managers thinking it's funny to place their 10 copies of Ben Carson's book in the comedy section. Of course, I'm sure that happens. But to think there's some like major national conspiracy where Barnes & Noble bookstore managers are working in tandem to hide every copy of Ben Carson's book, so much so that it'll affect the overall book sale numbers, that's just unbelievable.
What you will see is that my books were placed in the comedy section, which is really a Salonsky tactic of Islam. Right.
Now that you're bringing up Ben Carson, we were standing like literally a foot from Ben Carson.
Okay,
right after
did you tell him I said hi? This time.
I did not get a chance to do
my
that. I'm
God,
sorry.
Dude. Unbelievable.
But it's amazing. What's amazing to me is how no one, let's get to the electoral stuff. Let's start with Ben Carson.
Okay.
It's amazing to me that no one in this camp, I mean, he dropped out at this point.
Right.
Literally minutes after he dropped out, he came into this room with like maybe 100 people and had a speech.
Goodbye, everybody.
No one in this campaign thought of telling him, you know, maybe you should stop using the whole, you know, America is asleep, when will everyone wake up and vote for me line? Because that's the meme that's used to attack you for people. Like, they make fun of you for looking asleep.
Right.
But that aside, I learned something else from him, actually, that was really interesting. That shows, actually, that, again, conservatives are sort of just like progressives, but just completely ideologically on the opposite side.
Right.
They have their own crazy drunk uncle that they run into at Thanksgiving, and they need to know how to deal with. Except in their fictional scenario, yes, he's like a drunk, like, Democrat who's getting public assistance or talking about like his union.
Awesome. I want to be that Carrie. Like, what about my disability checks, man? I don't want to work. Work's a drag, man. I want to put out an open call that if there is any conservative watching this who has any type of position in conservative media production, I will get me like a gray beard and some type of bad glasses and wig, and I will play that dude in any single propaganda video you're putting out. I would have so much fun doing it. We about peace and love, man. Oh my God, that'd be great. So did any people like know you? Because you've beefed with a fair amount of people on Twitter. Like, did any of them say like, oh my God, that's Binder? Like the like regressive left, whatever guy.
The interesting thing is I saw people there who I definitely have destroyed on Twitter before. And it was like Chuck C. Johnson was there, like literally a foot away from me. Chuck C. Johnson.
We'll be beefing with him on Twitter anymore.
Well, he's actually banned.
Well, that's what I'm saying, right? Yeah, he's gone. Right.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But and then Kurt Schlichter was standing right next to me. I don't know if
you know who that is. I don't remember that one.
Cafe put out a funny video with him where he was talking about he's not Islamophobic, but then started saying the most Islamophobic things ever.
Oh, yeah. We played that guy. Right. I remember that guy.
Yeah. And then, there was a bunch of people like that I saw there that, you know, people who possibly could have known me, but I don't know if they really did. An interesting thing about the people there is, bringing up people who were there, like who would be using the internet, like Twitter and stuff, there's a lot of young people at CPAC.
Really?
And the interesting thing is that there's so many young people at CPAC because the student pricing is so much lower than the pricing for everybody else. And speaking to the people who were there, they seem to openly admit that the reason there's so many young people there is because they subsidize the younger people with their high-priced tickets.
That is unbelievable.
So
right.
So you have these conservatives who are, you know, I don't want to pay my taxes. And they're openly, like, touting happily that there's so many young people here, and it's because I subsidize them without even, like, realizing that they're saying.
Well, that sounds pretty cuck to me, frankly.
They should do more. They should roll that out on a national level, maybe.
Well, isn't that actually the funny? Isn't that the funniest part of this campaign? That like you know, we don't really have time to like get into Trump, but it's just amazing. Like, you know, a party that like they did a great line on Saturday Night Live with Mitt Romney, where you know they had the Mitt Romney guy was like, "We don't advocate racism. We imply it." you know, like as his like critique of Donald Trump, which is perfect. And it's just watching all of these, like you're talking about, like, oh, we subsidize young people. And now all these people are coming out and being like, you know, racism is totally unacceptable. Like this whole election cycle has actually made certain Republican elites have to like adopt, I wouldn't even say liberal talking points, but just like non-echo chamber talking points, because Trump has just totally owned that lane. And now they have to be like, well, wait a second, that's, you know, you can't demonize people like that, which is kind of hilarious.
Really, really quickly, we specifically spoke to people and asked them about Mitt Romney's speech and if they were affected by it in their views of voting for Donald Trump.
No one
or
was.
If they think the party as a whole. And let me tell you, the people at CPAC, clear as day, Ted Cruz's world. Ted Cruz's country, the majority, almost, I would say like 9 out of every 10 people we spoke to was a Ted Cruz supporter, a hardcore Ted Cruz supporter.
Right.
There was one guy that we spoke to, the William Temple guy who dresses up in the Tea Party garb. You always see him in the videos and everything.
Right.
He was one of the guys who was organizing the walkout if Donald Trump arrived. Like he's one of the reasons Donald Trump backed out of showing up at CPAC, because he heard there was going to be this big walkout. And we spoke to the guy who was organizing it. And we asked him, what about Mitt Romney? And he said Mitt Romney should shut up. Like people who despise people who despise Donald Trump hate Mitt Romney more because they view him as part of the establishment or as someone who lost.
Right.
And everyone we spoke to there, like for Cafe, we were speaking to these people to ask them this Mitt Romney question. There's a video we have up online you could check out. But the thing is, they totally are going for Cruz and even would consider Trump because they see what John McCain did. They were supposed to vote for John McCain. He's a more moderate guy. He'll win for us. They saw what Mitt Romney did. He's a more moderate guy. He's supposed to win for us.
Right.
And two times in a row, these people failed them. So this is what's happening. Like, this is what we're seeing. And the interesting thing specifically about Trump, just to quickly go off on a small tangent, is that the most left positions that people had who we spoke to were from Trump supporters.
I have no doubt.
Like
he's the moderate.
We hear all these it's probably not crazy for the majority of our listeners, but when you hear the mainstream media and people online talking about how terrible Donald Trump is, I mean, I think there will be studies in years to come on what Donald Trump's effect was on the conservative movement's move towards the left.
Yeah, no, I think that's – well, I mean, to the extent to which it translates to actual policy, because I think most of his supporters, it's just authoritarian and obviously overt racism. But I agree with you. I mean, what's also fascinating is that, you know, I'm going to get to this more in the second half, but it's like – now with John Oliver and Saturday Night Live and everybody else putting out these video, you know, like the white power for Trump and all this. And it's great. Like Trump has totally ran on bigotry and he should be called on it. But what's amazing to me is that it was really August through October that Trump said the most overtly bigoted. Like that's when he said most Mexicans who come in were rapists. That's when he said ban Muslims. That's like in the past couple of months, he has not made any of those types of appeals. So it's interesting to me, other than, you know, he played the nonsense with David Duke, but he was saying overtly bigoted stuff several months ago and it was all like a joke. And now it's like, oh, we really need to stop this guy at precisely the moment when he's actually pivoted away from those things. So if you really wanted to like just say from the beginning, no one who says this garbage should be in a position to be president, they should have done it from the beginning. But anyways, that's like my little soapbox. So before we...
But the thing there really quickly from what I was talking... Sorry, we have a second. The thing there really though that what we were seeing there too, I mean, these...
Yeah.
I'm talking about like people were specifically, you know, we asked them specifically about the Planned Parenthood thing.
Right.
Like, this was a conservative must. And everyone we spoke to, even the people who weren't Trump supporters, were like, the people who were Trump supporters were like, yeah, I agree. Planned Parenthood does do a lot of good things.
Right.
And then the people who weren't Trump supporters were even saying, you know, I don't support Trump, but it's because of his experience. The Planned Parenthood thing doesn't bother him.
Yeah, that's amazing. And
insane.
Also the health care thing.
And you remember that...
Yeah, the front runner of the Republican Party said George W. Bush is a liar and we support universal health care. I mean, that says something.
And that's why the Republican Party doesn't like him.
Right.
Like, they're not saying we have to stop this crazy guy because he called Mexicans rapists and wants to ban Muslims.
No doubt.
They're fine with that part. They want to stop him because of the... you know, progressive-leaning things he's saying.
Well, that was the joke that we always make, which is just like, hey, look, you should say it a little bit more subtly, but, you know, whatever. And now it's like, wait a second. That guy said people shouldn't die on the street? Fuck him! We need to get him out of here. Wait a second. You can ban Muslims. Okay, we can negotiate that. But did you just say that people shouldn't die in a pool of their own waste and filth while we drive past them in Ubers? You, sir, are not our nominee. All right, brother. I do got to run, but this was a major play. This was great, and let's do it again sometime soon. I'm sure I'll see you sometime soon.
Thanks for having me. Hi, Matt. Hi, Kelly. How you guys doing?
Awesome.
Even more awesome than Matt.
All right. There you have it. Talk to you soon, awesome. Man. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, everybody. We are running late, so we're going to get right to the fun half. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. The IMs are open. Become a member of the Majority Report today. You make it all possible. Majority.com/become a member. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Write us a review on iTunes. All that good stuff. We'll be right back in the fun half. Hey, Matt.